period. Visit quebec.ca/self-isolating for complete instructions on how to protect yourself and others. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 23 days into the month of December. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You're tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, audio from the 2019 Justice for Solly event, commemorating the life of Solomon Fakiri, a man with mental illness who died in Ontario Correctional Facilities custody. Then, an interview with a representative from Autistics for Autistics Canada that aired in April on the topic of the COVID-19 crisis. All that plus your weekly music picks right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at @avalancheckut.
Spread of COVID-19 is at a critical level in your area or a neighboring region. Getting together with family or friends is prohibited, and traveling to other regions is not recommended. More targeted restrictions have been put into place to limit the spread and prevent a lockdown. Learn more at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Continue to wash your hands, keep a 2-meter distance, and wear a mask when physical distancing is impossible. We need to act now. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
If you made a compensation claim for abuse at an Indian residential school, the records of your claim are secure. They will be destroyed in September 2027 unless you choose to keep them or share them. To learn more, call toll-free 1-877-635-2648 or go to myrecordsmychoice.ca.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. Solomon Fakiri died in solitary confinement in Central East Correctional Facility in Lindsay, Ontario, on December 15, 2016. Though they were unable to hold an in-person event this year due to COVID, this audio is from the 2019 event that was held here in Montreal to commemorate his legacy and fight for justice. This audio originally aired on December 25, 2019.
The Justice for Solly movement.
Movement and the Fakiri family, I would like to welcome you to the third annual Justice for Solly campaign vigil. On December 4th, 2016, Sullivan Fakiri was housed temporarily at the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario. He was awaiting a bed at the Ontario Shores Center for Mental Health in nearby Whitby, Ontario. About a decade ago, Sullivan had been diagnosed with schizophrenia. He had been identified as having urgent mental health needs by both his family and by the correctional staff at the Central East Correctional Center. Repeated requests by the Fakiri family to see him during Suleiman's time in temporary custody was denied. Just 11 days later, on December 15, 2016, the Fakiri family got a visit from two police officers. Suleiman was dead, killed while under government care. Later, the family found out that Suleiman's death was followed by an incident with a dozen guards at the Central East Correctional Center. Suleiman's body had 50 bruises. Both of his legs and hands had been restrained. He had been pepper sprayed. He was in segregation during his entire stay at the Central East Correctional Center. The coroner's report said that his death was unascertained. The first police investigation, which was led by the local police unit, the Kawartha Lakes Police Services, did not press charges against the guards without any explanation. The case was reopened in January 2019 by the Office of the Ontario Chief Coroner after an eyewitness, Mr. John Thibault, to the killing came forward. In the first investigation, the local police closed the case without ever speaking to the eyewitness. The case is now with the Ontario Provincial Police. The Fakiri family are waiting on the police's decision as to whether criminal charges will be pressed against the guards who killed Suleiman. The Justice for Solly movement was founded by Yusuf Fakiri and his friends to demand justice, accountability. No one has been held responsible so far for Suleiman's death. Tonight's vigil is taking place across six other cities in Canada, including Vancouver, Winnipeg, Toronto, Ottawa, Peterborough, Halifax, and here in Montreal. The Justice for Solly movement wants to ensure that another family does not suffer, like the Fakiri family, like the St. Amour family, like the Coriolan family, like the Moose family, like the Jew family, like the Quill family. Tonight, we ask you to help share this message. Please also like the Facebook group, Justice for Solly. We have five speakers here today. And then I will read out a speech that Yusuf, the brother of Suleiman,
schizophrenia. And I think it's important for us to recognize that all of us can suffer from or know people who suffer from mental health challenges. This is not something that just affects Suleiman Fakiri, but in fact it affects all of us. I personally know many people who suffer from mental health challenges and could be in a situation where they are placed under police custody, and for someone to die in that position is unconscionable. I cannot, you know, we should not be okay with the fact that someone was under government care and died with 50 injuries, and that, you know, you still think that like that death was unascertained. That should be unacceptable. Understanding the reality of what happened and like knowing the truth is actually a critical need for all Canadians. This could have been me, it could have been my family member, and I think that's so important to remember. And especially because, as others have said already, Suleiman was also a person of color. And so this illustrates the gaps in our mental health system, in the challenges that people of color and Muslims face in accessing mental health supports, in accessing therapy, in accessing other supports when they undergo challenges. Because Suleiman had actually been diagnosed and had incidents with, had been to the hospital multiple times, but he wasn't able to access the support that he needed. And I think that's the real tragedy here. Because I feel like, you know, we talk about build less talk, and I think we need to talk about how mental health affects all of us, not just a few people. And I think for me as well, the other thing that is really inspiring about this campaign that Yusuf, Suleiman's brother, and his family have launched is that this really is trying to like say to Canadians, how can we have a better conversation about mental health for all of us? How can you have justice in mental health for all of us. And that is a future that I will see.
We must adhere as much as we can to the ideal of justice, not only in our demands on authority, but of ourselves as well. We must uncover our most intimate and ugly prejudices about the mentally ill, the disabled, people of color, women, the poor, because it is these prejudices, nurtured and tended to in the privacy of our homes, which emerge when we are acting on instinct. I would like to remind us of an example from my religion, although there are many examples from other faith and secular traditions. From the Bible, Matthew 25:40, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me. And finally, the example of the Prophet Muhammad, who was closest during his lifetime to the poor, the downtrodden, the slaves, people called the oppressed of men. We must remember this example now as we
On December 15, 2016, my family received a visit from two police officers that forever changed our lives. My brother, Suleiman Fakiri, was dead, killed, beaten to death by multiple prison guards at the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario. I will begin by telling you about Suleiman and what he meant to the people who loved him. You will hear how he suffered and died while under government care. Finally, I will describe how Sully's tragic story inspired a national movement to demand accountability, transparency, and justice. Who was Suleiman Fakiri? He was more than just a victim of the prison system. Sully was my brother. He was the light of the lives of my parents and siblings. He was a man of brilliant intelligence. He spoke three languages, English, Arabic, and Farsi. He was a devout Muslim. He was a Canadian. He was a human being. The final point seems obvious, but it needs to be emphasized because people like Suleiman, who live with schizophrenia or other mental illnesses, are so often treated as less than human. However, the ultimate dehumanization occurs when already dehumanized people are locked in the viciously dehumanizing setting of our modern prison system. It was a cell, it was at a cell in one of those prisons where Sully was violently killed. Words alone cannot describe the horror of Sully's final moments in that prison cell. He was placed in segregation. He was restrained with his hands cuffed behind his back. His body was held down with leg irons. He was pepper sprayed twice. His face was covered with a spit hood. According to the eyewitness, he was kicked, punched, and stomped on. He had lacerations on his face and over 50 bruises all over his body. He was pronounced dead at the scene. Sully's story did not end in that prison cell. We refused to give up after the coroner's report stated that the cause of the death was unascertained. We refused to quit when the Kawartha Lakes Police Services decided not to press charges. We did not surrender to despair when our demands for justice were met with so much indifference from a cold system. No, we kept going. We continued to fight. We shared Sully's story with people across the country. We formed a nexus with other movements. We built a movement that spans the nation, focused on demanding accountability and justice. Today, as I speak, there are 7 vigils in 7 different cities across this country for Suleiman and for all those who have died in the prison system. Suleiman was more than just a statistic, he was a human being. He suffered and died within our prison system, a system run by our government, a system financed by our taxpayer dollars. What happened to Sully is more than just a mental health and prison problem. It is a Canadian problem. Recently, an eyewitness to Suleiman's killing came forward. At the request of the chief coroner, there is now a new police investigation led by the OPP, the Ontario Provincial Police. While this is welcome news, it is troubling that the underlying issues that led to Sully's death continue to persist. Sully's story resonates with people across the country because it is reflective of how society as a whole stigmatizes, dehumanizes, and mistreats people with mental disabilities. What happened to Sully is representative of serious systemic problems that have taken the lives of so many other Canadians, such as Justin St. Amour, Huang Na Tony Du, Kia John Dean, Devin Sampson, Machuar Madat, Terry Quill, Donald Moose, Pierre Coriolan, Nicholas Gibbs, Cass Jetties, Laura Strawn, Abdurrahman Hassan, Ashley Smith, Howard Hyde, Moses Beaver, Matthew Hines, and Edward Snowshoe.
each of these people left behind grieving families and expose a shocking lack of transparency and accountability that continues to this day. But this movement is about more than just remembering the victims of our prison system. It is also about preventing future victims. Over 1,000 days have passed since the family received that visit from the cops saying that Soleiman is dead, and not a single person has been held accountable for the killing. We are gathered here to demand accountability and transparency. We are gathered here to demand justice. 3 years is too long for any family. We are here to call on the Ontario Provincial Police to press criminal charges against the guards who were involved in Soleiman's death. Justice for Soli. Justice for all. Sincerely, Yusuf Fakiri, older brother of beloved Soli. Now, thank you. And if you could just bring that picture here and put it down. If you maybe just keep your hand on it too so it doesn't fly away, you can sit down there. For all those who have roses, please bring your roses and put them next to or just next to that picture. Please come forward. Yusuf wanted to say that we have 12 white roses. He wanted it to represent the 12 guards who violently killed Soleiman. And we will now wait. Thank you. We will now have a moment of silence for Soleiman and for all those prisoners and inmates who suffer from mental illness and who have died under care of a federal or provincial institution within the nation of Canada.
Of all orientations, of all social class, of all racial class, everyone should have access to dignified care. No one should be imprisoned. No one should be deported either. Today's vigil, we stand strongly with Soleiman's family and friends, and we denounce out loud what has happened, and we stand solid. I think it's beautiful that we can be here.
I'm Florence. I'm from the Caring for Social Justice Collective. It's a collective that wants access to health in dignity and care, traditional or alternative care for all.
My name is Irfan Tahiri, and I am a volunteer with the Justice for Soli campaign.
And how did you get involved with the campaign?
It actually started with a personal connection. I was good friends with Yusuf Fakiri, and Yusuf is the brother of Soleiman Fakiri. And as you know, Soleiman was the inmate who died in December of 2016. We're here demanding justice for Soli, as well as justice for all prisoners and inmates who suffer from mental illnesses within the correction system and the justice system. And we are demanding greater accountability and transparency.
And this is one of 7 national demonstrations. What are the other cities that are demonstrating in solidarity today?
We have demonstrations today across the country in Vancouver, Winnipeg, Toronto, Ottawa, Peterborough, Montreal, and Halifax.
And what is the significance of this date?
December 15th, 2016 was the day that Soleiman Fakiri died while he was a prisoner in Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario. So every year on December 15th, it's an annual vigil that we use to commemorate. So it marks the day of his death. And it's, as I said, day to commemorate the death of Soleiman and of all those prisoners who suffer from mental illness and who've died in the prison system.
And could you describe the care that Soli received once he was in the correctional facility?
A completely inadequate care. He was admitted into the center on December 4th, 2016. The moment he got in, the family notified the center that he was suffering from schizophrenia, that he required care, a particular type of care. And they were actually trying to move him to a bed at a mental health facility in Whitby, Ontario, which is a nearby city near towards Lindsay. That never happened. The family went to the prison several times throughout the 11-day period from December 4th to December 15th, 2016, requesting to see Soleiman. That request was never granted. And then on December 15th, 2016, he was found dead. Moreover, during these 11 days, he was placed in segregation, which is just a fancy way of saying solitary confinement. And this is quite puzzling because the provincial government at that time especially had policies and protocols in place that stated that individuals suffering from mental health issues should not be placed in segregation, but Soli was.
And could you describe the conditions surrounding his death?
The coroner's report found 50 bruises, laceration, severe trauma, signs that it was a brutal beating to death. We know there were 12 correctional officers who were involved in the beating that led to the death of Suleiman. There was an eyewitness, John Thibault, and he had witnessed all this, and he says that it was a beating by a dozen correctional officers against one person. There was an inquest, which is what usually happens after a prisoner passes away within the Ontario Provincial Correction System. The chief coroner, who is essentially a doctor who reviews this, said that the death was unascertainable. So the conclusion was, we don't know what caused this death. And so according to the family, that was ridiculous. It was the beating that killed him, the beating at the hands of 12 people. So it was unascertainable. The local police force did not charge anybody. But as we said during the event today, during the vigil today, as a result of the eyewitness, Mr. John Thibault, coming forward and explaining the circumstances that led to his death, this case has been reopened.
And when was the case reopened?
I'm not sure of the exact date. I believe it was early 2019 or late 2018, around this time. I know it coincided with around the same time when the CBC did a documentary about the death of Suleiman Fikiri. So around then is when the case reopened. So I'd say about 2.5 years, two and a half years after the death.
And could you describe the event today, how it was organized, what took place?
So I'm a volunteer with the Justice for Sully campaign. I got a lot of support, specifically from RADLAW, which is a social justice organization at the McGill University Faculty of Law, several organizations here in McGill. But this was very much a collective effort. I myself am from Toronto. I've only been living in Montreal for the past year and a half, and I've just been incredibly surprised and heartwarmed at how many organizations have come through, have come out, offered support. We're present here today. Some of the Muslim student associations and social justice organizations at the various universities like McGill, Concordia, UCAM advertised this event. So it was very much a collective effort organized through the Justice for Sully campaign.
And could you describe the significance of the white roses that were laid?
This was actually decided by Yusuf, who is the brother of Suleiman. There were 12 white roses who represent the 12 correctional officers who violently killed Suleiman. It's a stark reminder just for us here today of what led to the death, how it happened, and why that should not be tolerable anywhere. And the least we can do is at least raise our voices here, you know, across Canada to try and make sure that this doesn't happen again. Funding is one. I know mental health programs are definitely a way to go. But at the same time, reviewing the segregation policy, that I'd say is probably the most important one, especially with individuals who are suffering from mental health issues. They should not be placed in segregation. Moreover, there should be greater connection between prison institutions and mental health facilities. Report after report has been written. People have been able to identify the issues. People kind of have a sense of what the solutions are. But it seems like the systemic issues are still posing an obstruction to getting where we want. And so this event was really to target policymakers, politicians, and those individuals who are supposed to be looking out for the public interest, that they should take this issue seriously. Just on a final note for anybody listening, awareness is sort of the best way. If you can't stop oppression, then expose it. If you go online, we have a Facebook page, Justice for Sully. Sully is spelled S-O-L-I. We have presence on Instagram and Twitter, on Facebook. There's also a website, justiceforsully.com. Please tell your friends. For those who are listening, a simple email to your member of provincial parliament, as well as your member of parliament, demanding that they address this issue. As you know, there are prison institutions that are administered by the provincial governments as well as the federal governments. So targeting both of those levels of government with an email, you know, towards a member of provincial parliament or an MPP or an MP, I think that would be a first step in spreading the message as well. I think those would be my final words to people who are listening.
Thank you. arms left if you got. I wanna stand, but I'm talking to a cop. This piss on my boots, how'd you make it stop? Dance packs looking for a crash pad spot. I'm on the top of the pack. Pines. I'll be all one old lady. I'll be riding her line. Oh, smoking outside the cop you tell. I'm already never gonna fail you. Shaking in your clots. And no, they are not cagalizing your thoughts. You got one kind of trouble. It's the one that's on your back. Take note, there's still a hole in your heart. Take note, there's still a hole in your heart. Take note, there's still a hole in your heart. Take note, there's still a hole in your heart. That's a cold toe through the corn roads.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to Dance Pack by Volcano Choir. Up next is an interview we aired in April with Anne Borden from Autistics for Autistics Ontario on their plain language guide regarding the COVID-19 crisis. That's up now. Hi, welcome to the show. I'm here with Anne from Autistics for Autistics Ontario. Anne, would you be able to describe the history of your organization and your work with it?
Yes, it's great to be here too. Thanks for inviting me. Our organization was founded in November of 2017, and it was co-founded, I'm one of the co-founders, as a way for autistic people to be able to speak for ourselves. So it's an autistic self-advocacy organization. We do work in community education, political advocacy, and community support and community building.
And you recently wrote a plain language guide on COVID-19. Would you mind describing the contents of it?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I have it right in front of me. We came up with this idea, a couple of us in the group, to get something out there about COVID-19 that's in plain language, meaning that people can understand it. It's not full of a lot of technical jargon. And also specifically for autistic people, talking about some of the things that we would specifically be concerned about. So it starts out with talking about what COVID-19 is. explains why we're sheltering in place or staying at home, as we are here in Ontario. And then it gives some resources for people who use AAC, which is alternative communication devices, people who are non-speaking. Gives some resources for people who are non-speaking for navigating the medical system and what's going on and having access to communication. And then it talks a little bit about kind of coping and how to connect with people, how to cope with what's going on, with a little bit of advice as well for caregivers, if someone is living with a caregiver. And then a brief discussion about what might happen next, because that was a really big question that a lot of people have.
Could you describe why plain language is necessary in communications for COVID-19 and others?
It's really, really important, and we don't see very much of it. I'm really surprised with COVID how little communication is coming out of the medical field that can be understood by the average person. A lot of it's really technical, and you start looking at all these big words and long paragraphs, and it feels very overwhelming, and it's hard to understand. So it's really, really important, especially in the case of something where it's about health and safety, to make sure that it's plain language. The challenge with plain language is that sometimes plain language guides, if they're not written by actually disabled people, they can come across as kind of patronizing, right? And kind of like talking down to the person. So the best people to write plain language guides are people who are autistic, have Down syndrome, a variety of intellectual disabilities, really driving these projects, writing these projects, or at the very least, very heavily consulting and very heavily involved with these kind of guides so that they really speak to people in a way that is comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Has there been any other plain language guides that have been circulating? And how does yours differ from those that have already been created?
Yeah, there are some good ones. I will say Harvard did plain language, but then they kind of messed it up because they had it like by age group, like for 5 to 7-year-olds, like that doesn't really work. You know, cognition isn't kind of broken down like grades in school. However, Brandeis did a really nice one, and that could be read by people of any age, Brandeis University. Another great one was written by the Green Mountain Self-Advocates, and that was actually written by people who are disabled, have intellectual or developmental disability. So that was written in a really, really accessible way. Mm-hmm. And then there's Our Guide, and these are the major ones. There are also some good guides by AAC makers. Cough Drop, I think, has a guide. And there's another guide by Assistive Wear. Assistive Wear has been doing a lot of good guides and information for people who are using AAC to communicate.
And do you believe that the methods that the government has used thus far to communicate vital information regarding COVID-19 has been sufficient?
I think they could do a better job with plain language, especially by consulting with people who understand plain language and know how to write using plain language and benefit from plain language. I think for sure they could be doing a better job.
So governmental briefings on coronavirus only recently began offering accessibility measures, for example, sign language interpretation, the week of March 16th. Why do you think the implementation of methods of communication such as this were considered later in comparison to quote-unquote traditional communication?
I think it's that way so much of the time that disabled people are an afterthought. And I don't know why. I mean, especially federally, because they've made this big statement about how they're going to start, what's the expression that they use, like including disability in everything they do, like right from the start. So it was actually, I was surprised at how long it took them because I knew that they had this new commitment, but I haven't really seen a lot of legs to that commitment. And that was really disappointing. And I think there still is more work to be done to reach various disabled communities in the way they communicate.
The Accessible Canada Act in its current status primarily refers to federal physical, like governmental bodies. So, for example, government buildings. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that language should have been included in the creation of this act?
It really, really should have. And like any disability accommodation, it would benefit everyone, not just disabled people, if they had included language in that. The legislation also really didn't have anything for autistic people, and there was no consultation done with autistic people for that legislation. So there are a number of things missing there.
Are there methods of communication that the government hasn't yet implemented that would be able to better assist disabled people?
I think so. I think that they need to communicate more directly with disability self-advocacy groups and disability self-advocates and ask, mm-hmm. what are different communities and individuals need, and then respond to that need. I don't think having a bunch of quote-unquote experts who are non-disabled trying to just kind of do guesswork on the fly in the background as an afterthought is going to be a good way to do it. We'd like to see the government really reaching out directly to groups like ours and asking us what's missing and what we need. And we can provide it. I mean, it's very simple for us to do that rather than having them kind of doing guesswork.
And do you feel that the accessibility measures regarding language have been adequately communicated by caregivers to the populations that require them? For example, in the blog post, you mentioned that there are soundboards specific to COVID-19. Is this a feature that's widely known to caregivers as a resource?
I mean, I think the companies that make these boards are trying to get the information out there, but I don't think that it's entirely successful. I think if someone, it all depends on the quality of who's caring for the person and where the person lives. If they're living in a residential program where the people are really not putting effort into knowing what's new and knowing what's going on and querying these things, I don't think they're going to find them. You know, you would really need mm-hmm. something. This is all happening kind of ad hoc by private groups like ours. In the case of AAC, it might be a company that's making AAC, but if you don't use that brand, you might never hear about it. Ideally, you would have kind of a master post, a master list that the government had of accessibility resources, and then they would distribute these resources to all of the residential programs and all of the schools in terms of how they're doing education, the way that they're mm-hmm. doing education now, and they would have a way to get it to parents as well through various agencies, but that's not happening.
And why do you feel it isn't happening?
I don't think they have had a plan. I don't know. I mean, I'm just speculating at this point, but it doesn't look like they had thought about these various moving pieces when they were getting ready for something like a pandemic. So they need to reach out and ask people in the disability community. And I mean, really disabled people. In the case of autistic people, there is a whole bunch of non-autistic people who claim to speak for us, groups like CASDA and some of these other Autism Speaks. Mm. If the government's going and asking them, they're going to the wrong people. Those people are not disabled, and they don't know what it's like to be autistic, and they don't know what autistic people need. They need to reach mm-hmm. out directly to self-advocates to understand what's needed.
How does the level of like recommendations vary when provided by someone such as a representative from Autism Speaks who necessarily doesn't have autism versus directly from a person with autism?
Well, we're asking everyone in the broader disability community not to partner with or work with organizations like Autism Speaks or CASDA in particular, because they are, first of all, in the case of Autism Speaks, there's the broader issue of the genetic research and some of the eugenics that mm-hmm. they support. But aside from that, they also really follow what's known as the medical model of disability, where the disabled person is the problem and you fix the child to make them fit in a world that isn't built for them. The social model of disability tells us, why don't we make some changes to the world around us so that it can fit us. And it's just, it's the same for autism as it is for any disability, right? And I think that these big groups that kind of speak, they tend to speak as though we're broken puzzle pieces that need to be fixed, and what kind of therapies and things can we get so that we're not so weird and whatever, like, is really damaging to autistic people in many, many ways. And it doesn't make for successful outcomes either. If the government and policymakers are looking for successful outcomes, the only way you're going to have that is if we look at autism from the social model of disability and start making changes to the environment. And the only people that can really communicate what changes are needed, whether it's in school, whether it's in healthcare, or anywhere else, the only people who are really going to be able to articulate what's needed is actually autistic people. Like, for example, we go, Autistics for Autistics, our group, goes to the University of Toronto Medical School a couple of times a year, and we give a talk about to med students, how can you make your practice accessible for people who use AAC, for people with sensory issues, for people with communication differences, all of the types of challenges that we know that we have faced when we have tried to seek healthcare. We know what the barriers are that we face, and we know that there are some really simple solutions. And when we go in and speak to the med students about how they can make their practice more accessible, they're very receptive, they're very open. It's really a simple matter of teaching them some really simple accessibility measures that will have an impact on hundreds of people throughout their career. But we're the only ones doing it. It's the autistic people that are doing it. When you have an autism organization like Autism Speaks or someone coming in, they're much more likely to talk about how to identify autism or kind of make us seem like we're like sort of a germ in a petri dish rather than, hey, we're people and it would really help if you learned a little bit about this. It would really help if you could allow your patients to email if they are not able to use the phone, things like that. And that all comes from the grassroots, the disability rights community, not from these big organizations who claim to speak for us.
And have these organizations, for example, spoken or released anything in regards to COVID-19? And what are your thoughts on those?
I've been looking. Now, I haven't seen anything from Autism Speaks. I kind of don't like looking at what they do. Yeah. Because of the eugenics, et cetera. But I have seen some organizations that have put out guides. Generally, they're putting out like a guide for caregivers. And then it'll be this like massive long document of like how to talk to your child about COVID. So already they've taken the subjectivity away from the actually autistic person. They're not addressing autistic people, they're addressing their carers, and that just symbolic of how they tend to do things. And I just saw one today, I couldn't believe it, someone sent it to me, I can't remember who put it out. It was a Canadian group from the West, and they did this whole big thing, this whole big website, they probably had grant money for it, and they never once mentioned non-speaking, non-verbal autistic people. They had it all set up for autistic people who could speak, but we know that like 30% of autistic people are either non-speaking or partially speaking. It's quite incredible that a big agency like that would just render all those people invisible in their document.
And how has the community in Ontario been impacted by the crisis?
I think it's been impacted depending on where you live and who you are. So for some people who are living on their own or with roommates out on their own, they are facing, in many, many cases, because poverty is a big problem in our community, facing a lot of economic insecurity and a lot of worry about what might happen to their job, a lot of worry about what's going to happen with Ontario Works or ODSP or some of the programs that people are receiving. So there is anxiety and uncertainty and fear around the economic part of it. Then there's the social isolation, which everyone has to deal with, but which feels a little bit different maybe for an autistic person than it would for a neurotypical person. I don't want to generalize to all autistic people. I think there are some stereotypes out there that we all just want to sit home and pet our cat, and we don't really care that we have to stay home, and we're all introverts, and that's not really true. Like, a lot of autistic people are really extroverted, and I think anyone, whether you're autistic or not, is missing the community, missing the routine. But I think from a sensory perspective, it can be more difficult being inside than it might be for someone else. It can be particularly difficult for people who are living in a group home setting or in a family setting where they're not happy and not comfortable, or that's not welcoming for them. I really, really worry about people in those kind of situations where there may have been an opportunity to get out for work and get out for school, and now they're home. So there's that as well. And then there's the sense of not knowing what's coming, which is something that impacts everyone. But it can be especially frustrating and can really start to lead you down a path of reading and learning and understanding and getting super duper into understanding COVID to the point where it's like, oh, you know, okay, I've learned everything possible about COVID now. I need to find ways to decompress. I need to find ways to connect with other people. So I guess to summarize, there's economic concerns. There are stress concerns of depending on people's living situations. And then there are our sensory and coping concerns that do look and feel different than they do for a lot of neurotypical people.
And how is the government of Ontario dealing with this crisis?
I'm just giving my opinion as an individual. I was really surprised. I watched Ford yesterday giving a press conference, and he was kind of being baited by the right-wing media to make negative comments about Trudeau and by a certain reporter, and he deflected it, and he praised Trudeau. And I was really happy to see that. Like, it does seem like the government is taking its direction from public health experts, whether they're federal or whether they're provincial. So that was really comforting for me. The fallout once this is all over, I don't know. Like, I don't really know economically and socially what kind of impact it's going to have on our community, because so many in our community are already living at very low income and living on ODSP. That conversation isn't really happening right now, so it's really hard to tell, because it is a Tory government, what that's really going to be like in the future in terms of funding and aid.
And what are your opinions on the fact that the majority of disability support plans across Canada are below the poverty line, but with the bill that has been proposed, individuals would be receiving almost twice as much, for example, as recipients of ODSP. How do you feel that proposal impacts the level that we've set for essentially putting disabled people in poverty for no reason?
Well, it certainly points out the existing system, that the way that it isn't fair and the way that people are constantly living on the poverty line, and people who want to work a little bit get penalized for that. People who want to live with their partner or get married obviously are penalized right now under that system. This, for us as activists, it's an opportunity for us to raise awareness and say, well, compare the aid that's being provided by the government to what we're getting. It's a good opportunity to make people aware of the discrepancies and the second-class citizenship that comes from those discrepancies.
How can non-disabled people be allies to disabled people during this pandemic?
I think non-disabled people can be allies for disabled people by giving us a place at the podium. I think it's really, really important in any kind of project that has to do with COVID at all that disabled people are right there, front and center, because we're in a place right now where we have space in Ontario for everyone in the hospital. But as we know, down in the US, they're rationing care. And as we know, sometimes the rationing programs exclude people that are disabled and are discriminatory towards people that are disabled. And there's a lot of worry and concern in Canada that that could happen here, depending on the direction that things go with healthcare and this virus. So some guarantees and some real commitment to making sure that disabled people are not left out in those kind of scenarios, and that evaluation of our life and an affirmation that our lives have values, have value, is really, really important. And visibility for autistic people and all disabled people, as much visibility as possible as well, is really, really important right now. My concern is that disabled people will not be given life-saving medical care in the event that there is rationing, and that it could be built into the triage policies at hospitals. And I think what everyone would like to see now is a really ironclad guarantee of that. And as well, just in general, positivity about disabled people coming from our government as a way to reassure people that it's not going to happen here the way that it has been happening in the U.S.
If listeners wanted more information on your organization, what should they do?
Oh, yes. So we're on Twitter. Our Twitter is at A4A Ontario. So A number 4A Ontario. And we're also on Facebook, A4A public page, it's called. We also have a website, which is a4aontario.com. And that's where you can find the plain language COVID guide with pictures. And we're also going to have more plain language COVID guides, as well as kind of survival guides for dealing with sheltering in place, and lots of other resources that we're putting together, including a master list of AAC resources. So definitely check it out. So many things that we had going are kind of on hold. We just heard today, and it wasn't a big surprise, but we heard that our neurodiversity flag raising at Toronto City Hall that was supposed to happen on April 6th, of course, has been canceled. So on April 6th, we're kind of taking a page from Fridays for Future, and we're going to make our neurodiversity pride raising, our neurodiversity flag raising, go online and do kind of a virtual one. And then we're also doing some work with Arch Disability Law Center on a number of projects. And we have our outreach program for medical school education. We have a employment education project going on. And you can read more about our projects if you go onto our blog and look at our quarterly reports to kind of see ongoing projects. The last project I want to mention is our Little Neurodiversity Free Library, which is a library of books about neurodiversity that is going to be housed at the Center for Independent Living Toronto. Mm-hmm. And then it will travel from the Center for Independent Living Toronto around to different libraries, different community centers, and different places throughout the province, so that people can check out these books and learn more about neurodiversity.
Okay. Thank you, Anne.
Great. It was great talking to you. Thanks.
Falling down.
There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to Undertow by Yes We Mystic. That completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, you can check out our Twitter at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, you can contact The Avalanche at @avalancheCKUT or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news at CKUT.ca. Stay tuned for Hearsay, that's up next.
Dreams. walk behind me. They trick, they scheme, they tease. Felt like as a young girl, I really knew exactly what I wanna be, what I wanna be, what I wanna be, what I wanna be. And as a real world comes to its feet to shake my hand and greet with calmness and eloquence, never tired or in distress. What I'm supposed to be, what I try to be, what I thought I'd be, but I'll never be.
That was a song by Montreal's Blue Hawaii, and you are listening to In the Motherhood here on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's January 19th.